You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is being recorded the 28th of June, 2026. It's a Sunday evening here in Western Pennsylvania. I have so much material to do these shows on. I have, my folders are just bursting with things. That's all I do is write, thanks to my donors, thanks to people like you. And I never know what I've done before, or even if I do them again, and I could do them the same way. I have maybe another 50 books that I could put together. You know, I'm not going to do that because I'm not insane, but I have so much stuff done, at least in rough form. Much of the time, these are papers, as is normal, you know, is traditional for these kind of things, in vaguely rough form. And although sometimes they go outside of the basic parameters of what this show entails, implies, I'm going to be right in the center of it. And I know I've talked about it before. And it's an extremely interesting phenomenon, especially when you read Western authors try to make sense out of it. And that's the ideological significance of the Third Rome, and, you know, its connection to the formation of the Muscovite state, and even later on. My first book had that as its title, very pompously so. But then I started to think about the concept of the Third Rome, Holy Russia, which I always thought were more or less the same thing. I don't know really how they could be all that different. The overlap would be tremendous. I have been asked, I think it was ages ago, asked if that was a utopian ideology. And I said, first, it's not an ideology at all. And second, you know, the term utopia doesn't have to have a negative connotation. Usually it's, you know, Karl Marx ended up defining the term for the rest of us, saying that, you know, it's impossible to be achieved, or non-scientific, as he would say, or only something that isolated dreamers have, those who have mental illnesses have. There's one man, the dean of utopian studies, Lyman Tower Sargent, wrote the following. Even though utopias are potentially dangerous, we nonetheless need utopian visions. Loss of hope in utopia means a loss of humanity. But how can we stop a utopia turning into dystopia? Utopia, thought of in terms of perfection, purity, and exclusivity, imposes its version of a better life as the only possible one. On the other hand, the utopianism of opposition does not seek perfection or removal of opportunities for evolution. Its goal is progress and not repression of the human being. It is not utopianism that is at fault. The problem arises rather from the conviction that a particular utopia can bring about the only correct way to live. That might be surprising to hear someone like that. The Third Rome would count in that sense, but not in the normal conversational use of the term. Of course, utopia is the description of a future world that does not yet exist in great detail. Now, in the case of what we're talking about, the Third Rome was already in the process of being formulated. All the ingredients were there. Third Realm was not too far from being realized. It's only the sins of individual elites that kept it from being realized fully. And it just so happens that Lyman Tower Sargent was my advisor for my master's degree in political philosophy at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, who somehow is still alive. I guess in Lyman's future world, he's permitted to pompously rule with an iron fist while calling himself an anarchist. Lyman, in my opinion, represented the worst of academia. Gets paid a lot of money to do very little work. But his name did push me forward. Oh, he'd love to see what I'm doing now, but he did help me teach me how to negotiate the psychological minefield that academia truly is in these fields. But yeah, he's a jerk. I mean, he's but the last thing in the world he is, he's an anarchist on paper. He's a tyrant, in reality. It's very typical of those people. And he is the master, the leader of utopian studies. He founded the Journal of Utopian Studies many years ago. And he received an award from the Journal of Utopian Studies. So he gave an award to himself. Anyway. The concept of utopia, in that very limited sense, well, most ideologies would fit there. You know, Lyman's typical definition of utopia compared to just something, you know, an ideology would be, it's a description, like Thomas More, description of a future world that doesn't yet exist in great detail, where the aspects of justice and truth will be manifest. So I'm not sure how evolution fits into that, Lyman, but certainly it's in his interest to stretch that term as widely as he can. And he is certainly not in – not everyone agrees with him. But if you don't agree with him, you're not going to get into utopian studies. I guarantee you that. So but it is also, more importantly – the notion of utopia has to be taken from its Marxist, Karl Marx's definition of the term. There is good reason for it. Maybe something like, I wouldn't even say New Kazadia would be one. Kitej would be one. That would be an excellent example. So, the Orthodox idea. And this is strictly an Orthodox idea, but it also is an ethnic idea. Orthodox Russia as the Third Rome, expressed at least expressly the first time. Not it's not implied. It's said outright by St. Philotheos in his letters to Basil III, one of my favorite older Russian monarchs, the third part of the 16th century. He was taken seriously. It was a call to the Grand Duke, we call him the Tsar, as a matter of fact, to continue to push to manifest the universal purpose of the Russian kingdom, which is another way of saying the Russian nation. The birth of the idea is a little surprising. The young Russian state at the time, which just very recently had paid tribute to others, did not belong to the wealthiest or most populous countries in Europe. It will very shortly. In 1514, the Lithuanian Polish army defeated the Russian army near Orsha. 1521, Kazan and Crimean Tartars ravaged the suburbs of Moscow. And yet, beginning in the 16th century, the role of God-chosen Orthodox kingdom was declared. It is not the fantasy of some lonely monk, but the attitude of all educated Russian people, generally speaking, at the time. At the end of the 15th century, a society that's being formed, coming into existence, and will exist for another 200 years, will lay the foundations for the entire subsequent period up to our present day. This is an emergence of a new people, one destined to become the nucleus of all that became Russian later, and hence the center of the world, Russia has always been the center of the world, from you know, post-Renaissance times upwards. I should even say just modern times. These people are the great Russians. And in that, I do include Ukrainians and Belarusians. They began to take shape in the horde from the population of the eastern regions of Kiev. On the Kulikovo field, it passed the first test. By the end of the 15th century, it will be the foundation of the Moscow state. I want you to understand this in the strictest of ethno-sociological senses. Almost like as the first derivative from the ethnos, as Alexander Dugin would say. Great Russians were formed on the basis of the old ancient Russian people. Number of tribes, local ethnic groups, actually tribes would make more sense, but under new conditions. Core of the Great Russians specifically, the Eastern Slavs, near Vladimir and what is on principalities. That's where the Vyachi prevailed. And in the north, where the Finno-Ugric population was concentrated. Same time, you had close ties with the Golden Horde, most of which consisted of various Slavic tribes. Their nobility proper were numerically insignificant. But that, to some extent, affected the ethnic composition of the Great Russians. Took certain traits from them, despite them all being Slavs. I don't accept the idea that the Mongols were from Mongolia. And that grew later, when Ivan the Terrible took Kazan and Astrakhan. Now Russia was growing into one of the largest states, physically the largest states in Europe. Prior to that, it had been Poland. In other words, Moscow was, or the great Russian ethnos was being built through reconstituting the space that was that of the Horde. The word Horde just meant army, you know. But it had a center in Moscow. Especially after the establishment of Russian control over the Volga region up to the Caspian Sea, which, as many of you know, the old Khazar Empire was. Significant strata of the southern population felt massively populating these areas once the slave raids stopped. Now, the Turks were not Slavs. Whenever you hear any chronicle about foreign raiding into Russia for the sake of slaves, you read Jews. Not that they were actually doing the work, but they were taking the profit from it, which is a separate issue. I've dealt with it elsewhere. All ethnic groups are going to be fuzzy around the edges, something that no DNA test can ever fully comprehend. So, for example, the Finno-Ugric influence was non-existent in places like Kiev. In the northwest, in the Polotsk Principality, there were very few Turkish elements. And you had a few Baltic ones, though. But language, culture, religion, self-awareness of what we would call Russians were based on the Slavic origin and continued Slavic cultural type. The predominance of peasant labor, rural communes, and the corresponding ethnic worldview, a strong state. Great Russians can justifiably consider themselves to be the direct descendants of old Russia, based on the centrality of the Slavic language, the Slavonic language. Remember, the church took its texts largely from Bulgaria. You know, there weren't that many translators in Moscow when they first started. They couldn't read Greek, so It's mostly from Bulgaria that they got their religious texts. And, of course, the communal system. It's true, as I think Alexander Dugin says this many times, the Great Russians were a new people. Muscovite Rus went up to modern Russia. But the continuity of the elite showed the continuity of the ethnos. Those in the Vladimir and Moscow principalities, they were Rurikoviches. They inherited that original dynasty that united Russia. Again, I don't believe in the Norman thesis either, but that's a different story. But the composition did change over time. You know, Balts, even Circassians were included in this as time went on, but the orientation didn't change whatsoever. The elite was Orthodox and sought to strengthen the state. Anything else was an oligarch. Southern military nobility were very important. That southern border was always very difficult for the Russian state to seal. Muscovite Russia, high social unity. Whether it be its political class, intellectual forces. But it's not to say that, you know, it takes Kiev, not so much Galish, but it takes Kiev and brings it to a much stronger level. Borrow some things from the Horde, but it does create something new. This synthesis of Byzantine, Slavic, Bulgarian, even Scythian ideas to create this new nation, this extraordinary new nation. I know it's a cliche, and I hate cliches, but there was a historical choice made by St. Alexander Nevsky. Eastern Rus followed the path 200 years later, emerging from the Horde as a powerful and renewed Orthodox state. Scattered Slavs of Western Russia found themselves in a very difficult position of being considered heretics under the Poles. The Great Russians were a true nation. The West Russians, Little Russians, and Belarusians, they were almost tribal. Didn't mean that they weren't part of the broader nation. Now, I've made the point that Western authors always, you know, when it comes to Russia, they distort everything. But when you talk about either Holy Russia or especially the Third Rome, Western authors will go on and on about how this is an excuse for imperialism, for triumphalism, whatever it might be. But at the time, this didn't make a whole lot of sense. Even 75 years before St. Philophius, northeastern Russia experienced a massive demographic catastrophe by invasion in 1408 and famine. 1410, Tartar forces took and devastated Vladimir, completing the devastation, more or less, of northeastern Russia. And then, again, 1418, the Black Death reappeared. And it seemed to infect Novgorod and Pskov, and maybe 2 years later, showing up in Moscow. The chronicle says, snow fell heavily 3 days and nights. Few Russians remained after the plague. In poetic terms, of course. The Black Death reappeared a few times. 1431, 1436, 1442, and 1445. Making matters worse, you had civil war, that I've dealt with in my analysis of Basil III from 1433 to 1452. Again, adding to the demographic catastrophe. Well, Ukraine's dealing with a demographic catastrophe, and it has been since the early 90s. And we know the fact that it's true. The petition of the peasants, one area in Kostroma, said they may have a sixth of the villages who has anybody living in them. But a fifth of the villages that live within the Moscow sphere of influence were destroyed. That is extreme depopulation. When he had to fight the Tartars, Grand Duke Basil II was only able to get maybe 1,000 men, 1,500 at the most. He was defeated. He was captured. This was the era of the Civil War, fighting with his uncle, Yuri Dmitrievich, and his son Dmitry, nicknamed Shemyak. During that war, Shemyak blinded Basil, and that's where the name Basil the Dark came from. By 1452, he gained the upper hand. He smashed the remnants of separatism, and he forced Novgorod to swear obedience to him. And this is prior to even Ivan III, let alone Basil III. The throne went to his son, Ivan III. The Russian state was rebuilt. And when you have a strong sense of ethnic identity, rebuilding the population is not that difficult. Of course, you know, like say in modern America, where you hate when whites are supposed to hate themselves, they're not, white women are not having children. That's not the case in the, here. This is where a strong sense of mission or simple unity means that repopulation is not that tough. I know how to do it. Tartar forces eventually broken around 1490, and a few cities in northern Russia were taken from Lithuania. Now, Ivan III, now in his second marriage, the second marriage was to the niece of the last Byzantine emperor. Her name was Sophia Palaiologos. The marriage brought the Grand Prince of Moscow the coat of arms of Byzantium. This is where the Third Rome began. The double-headed eagle was brought to Moscow here. It certainly increased his standing among Europeans. You couldn't deny now that he was part of the Roman Empire, at least by marriage. And in 1505, Basil III ascended the throne as Emperor of the Romans. And then Pskov, Smolensk, Ryazan, Novgorod added to the Russian state. The unification of the great Russian ethnos with a single royal state changed the planet forever. The unity was based on religion and ethnicity, which were considered one and the same. Lev Gumilev, who I cite quite often, he argues that first half of the 15th century, during the times of the catastrophe, you did have a party atmosphere with two ideological movements. One calling themselves vaguely the grandchildren of the Kulikov fighters, and the zealots of antiquity on the other side. Either supporters of Basil II, the uncles of Basil and his sons. That was the struggle where the young Russian ethnos created a new kind of inheritance where it was now from father to son, eldest son, which was a change in psychology. Where, you know, previously it had been, you know, the eldest in the genus, brothers, uncles, whatever. That's not the case anymore. It was a psychological shift. You have to explain the development of a population growth now of strongly nationalist fighters willing to sacrifice themselves. It's unfortunate that, you know, famine, the strongest survived. the weakest died both physically and spiritually. So roughly in this period of time, you had marriages were done earlier. And the selection of the survival, the strongest, had this cumulative effect over time. And this is the foundation of the early Russian ethnos, at least physically speaking, I mean. Peter Turchin uses a term, asapia. It refers to something, you know, ethnic groups located on the border of different worlds. Two ethnic groups close together with different behavioral patterns and value systems. That's certainly the case here, at least in the northern part. The entire 14th century, northeastern Russia was under pressure from the Tartars, of course, a Slavic tribe, maybe with some Asian mercenaries from Central Asia. Some of them adopted Islam. The response was a growth in Asabia in the Moscow Principality. And as a result, the Kulikovo victory. In the 15th century, pressure from the in the steppe from this now Islamic movement intensified. There was another source, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, which at one time had been Russian Orthodox. It turned from the western half of the Russian people to an outpost of Polish Catholic civilization. And there were both equal problems, squeezed between two hostile groups. Russians had to become more unified than ever. That's what Turchin means by Asabia. It seems to be something that white Americans do not have. But back then, Russians either were to disappear or develop those virtues. This is where we get the origins of subornost, high forms of collective solidarity, a strong nationalist concept that motivated the Moscow state. I have written over the last 25 years, I've always defined nationalism, at least institutionally, as based on structures of solidarity or structures of survival. What's created by a group under intense pressure? That's the engine for the ethnic group to become political and a force for mobilization. Things that happen when you're suffering, what you have to do to get by, that becomes the foundation of the ethnos. It becomes a tremendous source of unity and emotional connection, both subjectively and objectively. You're not going to be marrying people who are your own people there. You're not going to be marrying your enemies, who often don't speak the language anyway. But the ethnic connection in Moscow, that tight nationalism, allowed Moscow to avoid what happened to Kiev. It was father to son, period. And that's what the Civil War was over, what we're talking about here. Yuri Dmitrievich displaced the 17-year-old Prince Basil and took the throne in Moscow, exiled his nephew to Kolomna in 1433. The nobles, the nationalists followed Basil. Yuri had to go to his nephew to invite him back. Then it happened again, 1446. The highest clergy, service nobles, who fled Lithuania and nationalist Moscow citizens, supported Basil the Dark, blinded in exile to Ugluk against the usurper Chemyaka. This is some of the foundations for what we call Russians today. This creates a tremendous strength, a tremendous sense of nationalism, long before the regime tells us nationalism ever existed. Not to mention, as if you read my first book, The ethnos came into existence also because of harsh conditions. Early winters, poor soils, sometimes remoteness from world trading centers, always being raided. But what did that do? If there's a strong sense of ethnic solidarity, it created a breed of warriors, service nobles, who then formed the backbone of the Moscow Principality, then the Russian kingdom, then the Russian Empire. That's where nationalism comes from in this particular case. We understand where nationalism comes from in any particular ethnic group's case. They all have their own story, and you have to understand it. You have to be a specialist in it. It's the formation of a militant nationalism, an armed nationalism. I talked about Montenegro several times recently. That's a tremendous example of it. It's necessary for survival. You'll be destroyed otherwise. George Fedotov, the famous Russian author, in exile, wrote about this in the article The Russian Man in 1938, quoting from him here. "This is a Muscovite man. He was forged by a difficult historical fate. For two or three centuries, harsh hands crushed Slavic dough, beat, broke off recalcitrant elements, and forged unusually resistant form of solidarity. Peter's empire covered the Muscovite kingdom from above with European culture, but it still can only hold on to the Muscovite man." In other words, it needed the Muscovite man to function, regardless of whatever revolutionary ideas he had. He couldn't function for 10 minutes without that basis and strength. So when Novgorod, fairly wealthy, and Pskov were annexed, and they were, of course, Orthodox and Russian-speaking, so it's not really an annexation, it's a reunion, you had a strong sense of all-Russian patriotism or nationalism. It is still true, though. Ivan III put Pskov and Novgorod under just family members. That threatened the unity of the Russian state. That's the old way of doing things. And the Pskov nobility had a problem with this. They didn't like this concept of the Uthiapanage princes. They only would obey the Grand Duke in Moscow. "That is our true sovereign," they said. Whether they were a majority or not is another matter. But they realized the danger. At the time, Russia needed a strong central source of power, I should say, of authority. The Russian language, whatever variation you might get, even Russ early stages of Lithuanian statehood, which was Russian, that was the focus. State, religion, and class. That served as the connections and the building of closer integration into a nation. That comes straight out of Hegel's understanding of things. The service nobility, these tough guys that came out of the demographic crisis, orthodoxy, especially the monastic orthodoxy, these were instruments of socialization and inclusion. But there were others to be integrated, sometimes widely apart from one another. Under Moscow, it became almost an offensive weapon. Wherever the Russians may have spread, if there weren't, great Russians living there, they integrated and enculturated very gently. They didn't oppose anything. That was a stupid thing. This was purely a hearts and minds matter. The way a few scholars have put it, Solovyov and Dugin, a few others, they created the conditions for the Russian choice to be taken for granted. For those who rejected it, they probably had to leave, but it was no big catastrophe for them. It was only under Peter and his successors that Russification took on more rigid forms, because they had lost the inner concept of what it was to be Russian under the Moscow, in the Moscow world. Russification became more abstract. But even there, radicalism, this is kind of extremism towards native ethnic groups proceeded from strict government instructions. Russians themselves, in the face of migration, they've never been known to be arrogant or chauvinistic or anything like that. So long as you are pro-Russian, of course. There's always been flexible strategies here. That was part of the survival of the ethnos. From the moment of her baptism, old Russia was a connection between Byzantium and Bulgaria. The Russian Metropolia was just one of the dioceses under the Patriarchate of Constantinople, where they were ordained. Some were Greeks. Byzantine priests and monks, architects and painters came to this young ethnic civilization. And the synthesis began. Educated Russians received Byzantine culture through the Bulgarians and Serbs, no doubt. No doubt. But it was never separated from the Byzantine ethnic center. It was a constant cultural exchange. Constantinople, or Tsargrad, was for the Russians the center of religious and even legal power. The emperor was considered the head of the Orthodox world after Byzantium fell. But the collapse of the Byzantine state, end of the 14th century, Chernovo, the capital of the Bulgarian kingdom, fell to the Turks in 1389. Same year, the Serbs suffered a crushing defeat at Kosovo, lost their independence. 1395, the Turks finally defeated the Bulgarians, captured their monarch. The last heroic city, Bulgaria, Vidin, fell in 1396. The Turks surrounded Constantinople from all sides. And the only reason that the capture of the city didn't happen right away was because of Tamerlane, destruction of the Turkish army in near Ankara in 1402. It was still a desperate situation one way or the other. What did many of the elites in Constantinople do? Under the onslaught of the Turks, Byzantium sought protection from Western Europe. And you know the story. At least most of you know the story. They were ready to accept the supremacy of the Pope, and the council was fear of Florence, 1438-1445, uniting the churches on Latin terms. And it was signed by Patriarch Joseph II of Constantinople, and the emperor, Janiev Palaiologos. Mark of Ephesus, one of our great saints of the day, refused to deviate from the Orthodox position. He gathered his own sobor in Jerusalem in 1443. Patriarch of Alexandria was there, Antioch and Jerusalem cursed the union. 1450 in Constantinople, the opponents of the union deposed Patriarch Gregory, elected the Orthodox Athanasius as Patriarch. 1453, as we all know, the Ottoman Turks under Sultan Mehmed II took Constantinople and put an end to more than a 1,000-year history of the Byzantine Empire. However, I will add, as I've said before, that many of the Turks were brought into Europe. If you go back to my talk on the Serbian despotate, oftentimes Turkish forces were brought in as mercenaries. So so it's not like they invaded southeastern Europe. They were already brought there. Very, very short-sighted, of course. They were already there. They were being, there's a lot of, there were Slavic men in Mehmed's armies. That has nothing to do with the lack of any kind of national spirit. That's not the case. It has more to do with settling scores and trying to maintain power, one prince or another. Now, the infamous Metropolitan Isidore, who accepted the Fiera Florence Council, was made into a cardinal, no less. He arrived in Moscow in 1440 or 1441, and he immediately demanded the recognition of the Union. He was thrown in prison. Eventually, he was allowed to leave, flee to Rome, and of course, at that point, Moscow was independent. The Metropolitan of Russia, without prior consultations from Constantinople, for the very first time, elected the Bishop St. Iona, who, by the way, his feast day is today, a protege of Basil II of Ryazan. So what was a de facto independence of the Russian Church? The fall of the Second Rome was perceived in Moscow as God's punishment. However, we need to make it clear, most Greeks did refuse the Union. It was unpopular all over the Eastern world. It was something that elites did out of sheer desperation, and Western assistance never came, no matter what they did. There was even an attempt to try to remove Metropolitan Iona in 1460. The same man who fled to Rome consecrated Gregory the Bulgarian to the Russian Metropolitan. It was actually two competing bishops there. Gregory came to Lithuania and founded the Metropolitan See in Novogrudok. The Kiev Metropolia at the time included the Orthodox lands of Lithuania and parts of Poland and was dependent on the Patriarch of Constantinople and the Polish king for some time. So the attempts of the Kiev Metropolia to extend its authority to Russian lands were rejected. And this is why we have to talk about Ivan's campaign against Novgorod in 1471. Because prior to that invasion, you had the civil war in Novgorod between supporters of Lithuania and supporters of Moscow. The pro-Lithuanian party, led by the slave-owning Boretsky clan. Now, this is your classic oligarch. Insisted the ecclesiastical subordination of Novgorod to Kiev, while Moscow supporters demanded that Novgorod be left under the jurisdiction of the Moscow Metropolia. There was also a class difference there. The lower classes tended to support Moscow. Metropolitan Philip of Moscow and Ivan III repeatedly appealed to those in Novgorod, but the confusion and the fighting continued. That's where the campaign ultimately came from. And the campaign really was about preserving Orthodoxy from the West. This was a legitimate cause, and it was indeed a political cause. Moscow was aware, and this is something that I talked about ad nauseum in my first book, that places like Novgorod, being in the far west, they were willing to sell out so as to maintain their riches, to sell out their church and their nation for a promise of its preservation from the Catholic in Catholic power, especially Poland. They were willing to completely change everything, to completely apostatize for the sake of maintaining their lands. This is why the lower classes hated them so much. Put all this together, and you realize why Russia had to be an autocracy. There was absolutely no other choice. There had to be a militant national body. It was surrounded by enemies. What else could it be? Ivan III had to rule as a singular Grand Duke or Tsar, actually, after a second marriage. Ivan, by grace of God, the sovereign of all Russia. Then he added the name subject to the Russian state, the sovereign of Russia, the Grand Duke of Vladimir, Moscow, Novgorod, Pskov, Perm, Ugra, the Bulgars, and a few others. Ivan III gets all the attention, but Basil III should also get, you know, it's also extremely important here. We're talking about the birth of a nation. It could have very easily died, been destroyed, which would have satisfied plenty of people today, I'm sure. They did use their version of Russian, of Roman court ceremonial. There were conflicts, of course, over the symphony, the priesthood, and the kingdom. The Russian ethnos, the Russian nationalism itself, it survived and grew because it was partially based on the equal importance of both powers, the spiritual and the so-called secular. It's a natural outgrowth. I mentioned before, I said, you know, especially the monastics in the church were, monastics, this is also the case in Germany. Monastics are usually supporters of unification. We all know the great St. Joseph, abbot of Volok, or Volokomansk, in his epistle to Second about heretics, Basil III about heretics. He pointed out, he said, the power of the Russian sovereign was given to him from God. You, my lord, he says, you're the autocrat, you're the sovereign of all Russia, by God's hand. The church did expect to influence the decisions of the Tsar, which makes a lot of sense. Certainly the case in that era under Ivan and Basil. But the clergy, when they got political law, were connected to building up the prestige of the central power. Either that, or there would be no Russia. Now, let me take a minute here. I know I've done this before. But for newer listeners, the term Tsar does not come from the Latin Caesar. It has a much more ancient root. It actually comes from Persia. And I base this on the great historian Karamzin. You could find it in Babylonian names, you know, Nabonassar, Samalassar. You know, you see the S-A-R, which comes down to the king possessing light or the will of God. S-A-R, Z-A-R, or T-S-A-R, Russian meaning the dawn, or modern Russian would be Zalia, suggesting the light from the sun. The Hebrew name for that would be Sarah, very similar, and even the English Sir. The basis of the name, all of these Persians, the last name had the last syllable of Tsar, much older than the concept of Caesar. It means a man greatly beloved by God, even a God hero. But even more, less esoterically, a Caesar was, under the Byzantines, a tributary monarch. He was not an emperor. The emperor was the Basileus. So when Ivan IV started using Tsar in 1547, he used it to place himself on a par even superior to rulers of Constantinople, ancient Rome, the Horde, Bulgaria, whoever, the Roman Empire. Whoever was around. We could start this from 1472, where Ivan married Sophia. So, if you are creating this concept of equality or even superiority, you would not use the title Caesar. It comes from another source. Now, what's the connection there with the Third Rome? I think it should be pretty clear. The elder St. Philotheus, he never ascribed any sense of election to the Russian nation, although it's hard to avoid it. He didn't say so expressly. you know, we think of the Jews in their sense of election. Unfortunately, the concept then seems awful. But the concept of the Russian, starting roughly around then, especially in Philotheus' mind, was expressed through the concept of Rome, which was understood as synonymous with universal. Now, keep in mind, and this is extremely important, the concept of the national and the universal are not necessarily opposing pairs. Dostoevsky made the same point many years later. Only once St. Philotheus mentions the Russian land, but also the land means nation. He's not referring to soil. So you can't be talking about any kind of what they call a messianic concept that inspired Philotheus. No, what it truly was the total responsibility, the crushing responsibility of the Moscow Tsar, who after the fall of all the existing Orthodox kingdoms remained the only, well, we would say the only external guarantor, and of course the military defender of Orthodoxy. This is not a job anyone wanted to have. You were responsible for God, to God for everything. But the Third Rome was a concept that was implied through all this period of time. Second half of the 15th century. And when Byzantium fell in 1453, Ivan declared Greek treachery destroyed it. It was clear that Byzantium was murdered. God's punishment for treason to Orthodoxy, both using the Turks as bringing them into Europe, giving them a foothold, more than a foothold, as well as their own seeking protection from the Pope, which of course would never show up. And the sermon from the scriptures and from Latin, 1461, 1462, the Byzantine Tsar is credited with recognizing that the ends of the earth are Rus and Greater Orthodoxy. That's Jeremiah. Talk about that here in a minute. In addition to the chronograph in 1512, talking about 1453, story, which was translated from the Greek. It was a lament about the capture of Constantinople. It ends with the words, the Russian chronicler, all the pious kingdoms, Greek, Serbian, godless Turks destroyed and subdued their lands. But our Russia is growing, younger, and rising in strength. To her, almost for Christ, merciful Christ, let her grow and expand until the end of time. So it wasn't just the Third Rome, it was the new Constantinople. You see this in the Metropolitan Zosima's exposition of Pascha, 1492. He says, and now the blessed and Christ-loving Grand Duke Ivan, sovereign and autocrat of all Russia, is the new Tsar. Constantine, the new city of Constantinople, over Moscow and the whole Russian land, he is sovereign. Zosima was the first to point out the transfer of the capital, you know, the so-called political capital of Orthodoxy. I personally don't see how you can avoid some sense of election with St. Philotheus, no different than the Israelites were given a strong sense of election in the Old Testament. Of course you can't really live up to it. If anyone bothers to read the Old Testament, it's just one story of the Israelites being punished after another. They had a very high calling, very high standard. In 1523, Philotheus wrote to the deacon Mikhail, the representative of Basil III in Pskov, the very famous A Message of Evil Days and Times, which is the title. and it rejected the concept of the destinies of kingdoms by the stars, which came from the astrologer Nikolai Bulev. To some extent, the Third Rome was at war with that. Philotheus wrote the Epistle to Grand Duke Basil in the first half of the 16th century, which included discussion of the idea of the Third Rome in both epistles. Yeah, the concept of the Third Rome is not given a whole lot of space, but the brevity of its presentation doesn't negate its power. In the Epistle on Evil Days and Times, he opposes the predictions of destinies of kingdoms by the stars, like you had in Persia. It's not from the zodiac, it's from God who punishes apostasy. The Byzantine kingdom was ruined because the Greeks betrayed the faith to the Latins and got nothing in return. Even if you point to the prosperity of the so-called prosperity of the Latins, it meant nothing. They renounced the Orthodox truth, quote, for the sake of unleavened bread, very common way to explain it. The Roman state was indestructible because Christ was born within it, as he says. May you see Christ-loving and God-loving. The whole Christian kingdom has come to an end because one kingdom, our sovereign, according to the prophetic book, two kingdoms have fallen, and the third stands, and the fourth does not exist. Many times the Apostle Paul mentions Rome as the whole world, as a common description at the time. Obviously, it's not literal. He doesn't think Rome was the whole world, and it was very common to say that, but these are connected. The formula, Russian kingdom is the third Rome, was given here. And it's clear we're talking about nations, kingdoms, not cities. The Roman kingdom embraces all Orthodox men, the entire Orthodox world. That's why you have three crowns of Philotheus, and the fourth Rome rejected by him are not related in the four kingdoms of the prophet Daniel. Interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Daniel in the Old Testament spoke of four pagan kingdoms in chapter 2, about the four beasts, meaning the four kings, the kings of Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Old Rome, in chapter 7. They will be followed by the eternal kingdom of the nation of saints of the Most High, also Daniel 7. This, in Daniel's sense, the fifth kingdom is the coming of Christ, who founded the eternal kingdom, his church, and the state that would protect it. Unless it was protected, it couldn't function. There were too many enemies against it. The eternal kingdom, the church, can only be followed by one thing, the kingdom of the beast. The Roman kingdom is the kingdom of the church. Fourth, of course, is impossible. And what Daniel said at the time was relevant, but it isn't in this case. The Roman kingdom is the church. What comes after the third is Antichrist. After the fall of the Greeks, the second Rome, Russia became the center of the true faith in the world. With the so-called death of the last third Rome, the coming of the Antichrist will show itself. That means the concept of the third Rome in St. Philotheus is eschatological at its root. It deals with the end of the world. Philotheus, he writes his epistle to Grand Duke Basil. Basil III is called an Orthodox czar, who shone in power instead of the Roman or Greek rulers, said again about the reason for the fall of the First and Second Rome. The First, the Church of the Old Rome, fell through the unbelief of the Apollinarian heresy, which is a belief that only the mind of God is divine. The mind of Christ is divine. For the Second Rome, Constantinople, was dissected by the grandchildren of the Hagarenes with axes. Now the Third, the Holy Catholic Apostolic Church, the whole celestial empire, shines greater than the sun. He also mentions the impermanence of money. He says, do not put your trust in gold, wealth, or glory. All of them are gathered together and remain on the earth. Philotheus urges Basil to fulfill three tasks. Number one, to correct the people's habit of incorrectly signing the cross, to give empty churches bishops, and to eradicate sexual immorality. Warfare and struggle that destroys morality in general. So at the end of the epistle, Third Rome is repeated, because the whole Christian kingdom has fallen into ours. In other words, the monarchy, the Christian kingdom has fallen into our lap, so to speak, because two Romes have fallen. The third is the end, and the fourth shall not be. St. Hippolytus says, when we see Rome, this is, of course, many centuries before, when we see Rome surrounded by the howls of the Persians, and they descend on us from the Scythians in battle, you will surely know that this is the Antichrist. Moscow was commemorated by Philotheus, really in the context of the existence of the Church of the Dormition. He actually said, you know, that this is, there is the holy city of Moscow, the church, with the holy glorious Dormition, and the most pure Theotokos, who signs more than the sun. Very, very common compliment. By Rome, he doesn't mean the city, but the Orthodox Roman Empire, a kingdom that's primarily spiritual, embodied after the fall of the Second Rome. It preserves the coming of Antichrist. But its significance is in spirituality, not in earthly power. Now, this isn't the same thing as the translation of the empire, translatio imperii, concept of the transition of earthly power from one empire to another. That was a widespread notion in medieval Europe. There's no, you know, there was no reason to contrast the Third Rome idea of Philotheus with the ideas about Holy Russia that developed in the same 16th century. Both mean the God-saved kingdom. Now, whatever else the Third Rome was used for was a different story, but it comes down to being one and the same. Philotheus of Pskov, one of his, you know, that letter was one of the most significant things that's ever been written in Russian and in European history. Hierarchs of the foreign Orthodox churches knew all about them. In 1589, you had the established charter on the establishment of the patriarchal throne in Russia. That was the election of Metropolitan Job as Patriarch of Moscow. A speech that was addressed to Tsar Fyodor Ionovich, the Archbishop of Constantinople, Jeremiah II. He speaks as if he is Philotheus. This is what he says. Because the old Rome has fallen by the Apollonian heresy, the second Rome, which is Constantinople, possesses the Hagarene grandsons of the godless Turks, but yours, O pious king, the great Russian kingdom, the third Rome, surpass all piety. And the whole pious kingdom is gathered into one. And you are one under the heavenly Christian king. It's called the whole universe and all Christians. Well, Jeremiah is, it's pretty significant when you call your own nation that. Patriarch of Constantinople, 1589. That was a very difficult job. But he was aware that his glory had fallen because of that. But after the election of the Patriarch of Moscow, Third Rome was kind of taken for granted. Yeah, there were seven hills in Moscow, you know. You had a triangular Kremlin. The royal chambers were built according to the Roman quadrata principle, etc. But then again, we get to the modern and postmodern era. It was set into oblivion from the alien rule of Peter, let alone the new rite. The ideas of Elder Philotheus were remembered only in the really in the second half of the 19th century. The Slavophile idea began to resurrect it. It was gone for a long time. Sergei Soloviev actually was one of the promoters of this concept. In his History of Russia, 1856, the third chapter, part 2 of volume 5, he deals with the Third Rome in some detail. Kluczewski, as I've already mentioned, in the course of Russian history in 1902, he says, Philotheus hardly expressed only his personal thoughts when he wrote to the father of the terrible, Ivan IV, meaning Basil, that all Christian kingdoms converged into one of his kingdoms, that he was the one Orthodox sovereign in the whole celestial empire, that Moscow was the third and final Rome. Now, Ivan III called himself the Tsar of Russia. The Poles called Russia Muscovy. That was pretty common. I don't know if it was insulting or not. The infamous mercenary named Jacques Margaret. He served as a mercenary in Russia from 1600 to 1606. Absorbed a lot of Russian culture and stated the following. It's a mistake to call them Muscovites, not Russian. Not only do we who live in the distance, but also the closer neighbors do. Everyone does. When they're asked for what nation they belong to, they answer Rusak, or Russians. When they ask for where they come, Moskova, Moscow, Vologda, Ryazan, and other cities. All Russia can be understood as such, but never Muscovites or any derivative. Now, since St. Petersburg has been founded, we use Moscow to refer to this, you know, first part of Russian history. I mean, no one could have foreseen what happened, both at the beginning and at the end of the 20th century. But by, say, the 1860s, the idea of the Orthodox Empire was very real. I said 100 times that Peter and his, you know, the Petrine Revolution that ended, but really not even until the reign of Alexander I, the concept of the Third Rome was gone. It was eventually resurrected. I mean, the church had been hollowed out completely, as I've said. 1860s, you started seeing it a lot. Now you also had Vladimir Solovyov, the famous philosopher, who talked about the universal unity coming from Slavophilism to ecumenism, the unity of humanity into a free theocracy under the rule of the Russian Tsar and the Pope, who, you know, back when I was a union, I was fascinated with. Even there, it's only really a secondary issue for him. When Pan-Mongolism came out in 1894, Soloviev was disillusioned with the theocratic utopia and the future of Russia. The symbolist poet Alexander Blok in his Scythians, he deals with it tangentially, maybe. The Silver Age, he had more. Maybe more than that. You had a revolution in Russian religious thinking. It started to become very popular. Even Dmitry Merezovsky, in his article Revolution and Religion, 1907, devoted to Russia's failed attempt to become the Third Rome. In other words, Peter's efforts to, I'm quoting here, push Russia into Europe in order to make Russian, make the Russia the Third Rome worldwide, ended in failure. It's hardly possible to imagine what all-destroying force a revolutionary tornado will acquire in the depths of the national element. Which is certainly a very powerful statement from someone who is probably a demonist. When the First World War breaks out, that concept also starts to dissipate. By the way, the Third Rome and the Third International are not related. It's a coincidence. It's not even an interesting coincidence. You know, this, I'm talking about Nikolai Berdyaev, who, you know, it's fun to read. I like reading him. He was in exile. In 1937, he published, actually in English, The Origins and Meaning of Russian Communism. And he claims that communism has become a means of realizing the messianic sentiments that have always existed in Russia. According to him, the search for the true kingdom is characteristic of the Russian people throughout its history. In other words, he tries to connect what cannot be connected. The mere repetition of the number three is of no interest. Marxism was a Judaic, not a Russian idea. Berdyaev, in this case, is dead wrong. There are very few Russians involved in the Russian Revolution. But this has become absolutely dominant for those interested in Russia. Trying to think of that there was such a thing as Russian communism. There is no such thing. Berdyaev was widely quoted in the West. People like Brzezinski and Richard Pipes quoted him quite often. So communism was Russian after all, huh? Today, it has radically increased. Vladimir Putin has a very special place as someone who is able to rebuild a depopulated and dying state. It's not the first time in Russia that it's been done. It still can be done in Ukraine if the military finally just overthrows these scumbags and connects itself with Russia, Belarus, Central Asia, China, etc. Putin does have a role in this drama, indeed. Anyway, thank you for listening. If you've come this far, I appreciate it. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.